We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 138.
On today's show, we talk about an underwater Neolithic site, Clovis Points in Michigan, and a Polish sword hoard.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to another news episode, everybody.
Hello.
So we've got three articles for you, and in case anybody is following our travels, we're still in Washington State. We are in the southern part of Washington State, about to cross into Oregon as soon as we finish this podcast and get going.
Yep. So, heading south.
Yep. We're at another harvest house near Battleground, Washington, called La Uva Fortuna Farms. Doesn't that mean like the egg farm?
Fortuna means luck, I think.
The lucky egg farm?
Maybe.
Because uva.
Yeah.
Isn't that like egg?
I don't know. You're putting me on the spot here. I'm not sure.
You are Italian.
Okay. 100 years ago, my family came here.
Come on.
So.
All right. So anyway, it's a pretty cool place. They got lots of different things here, like 12 RV spots. And we had a good meal last night with some friends. And it's a good time. So.
Yeah, definitely enjoyed it.
Let's talk about something completely different. The Croatian coast. A place we also would like to RV, but probably won't be able to.
I mean, we certainly won't be able to bring this one.
No.
Maybe we could get one in Europe.
That would be super sweet.
I don't know, though. Could you imagine driving like a long RV bus around European town?
I think it's more van life.
Yeah.
Over there.
Yeah. I think you got to do the van life
thing. Rent a van and do it.
Yeah.
So. All right. So this first article is entitled, Archaeologists Discover 6,000-year-old island settlement off Croatian coast. And again, I thought this was super cool just because Croatia sounds like an amazing place to go.
Oh, I know. I'd love to go there.
Yeah.
And the photos are beautiful.
Yeah.
As usual.
Absolutely. And this kind of also fills, I guess, some dreams of mine, because I have been known to, usually in response to something we're watching on TV or something like that, I'll pull up maps, just like maps on my iPhone, and start looking around at something, trying to find something. And then like an hour's gone by and I'm just looking at maps.
You're just like looking at like the satellite image of places.
Just places. And I'm not even really looking for anything. I have no expectations. Yeah. I just like to see what things look like from that perspective. And so does Mate Perica, the archaeologist, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Check out the link in the show notes. But he was looking at satellite images of Croatia's coastline. Didn't say why he was doing it. Probably for the same reason. There's lots of stuff under the water.
Yeah, I do wonder if he was doing it on purpose, though, because I think it's pretty common knowledge that you can use satellite images sometimes to find things that you wouldn't be able to see if you were on the ground.
Right.
Now, I think you have to be careful with that, because wasn't there like some nonsense about like people finding pyramids in jungles and like they weren't actually, and it was,
they weren't actually undiscovered.
Yeah, like, well, like, there's that.
Know about them.
Yeah. So anyway, you have to be careful about that.
Right.
But I think there is a lot of stuff that you can find just by looking at satellite images.
Well, I think the moral of that story is, if you do find something that looks like it could be obscured, or maybe it's in an area and you're like, man, is anybody like, can I really be the only one that has possibly seen this?
Right.
Because I think people jump to two conclusions. They either think somebody else must have seen this and then they move on, right? Or they're like, wow, am I the first one to look at this? In either case, you need to check.
Mm-hmm.
You need to tell somebody that can look at the records and say, yeah, we know this exists or we don't. And then, you know, let them proceed.
Yep. Talk to an expert is definitely your first.
Yeah.
If you're not the expert yourself.
Right.
Talking to an expert is your first step.
I know. And that we'll talk about the rest of the article here in a second. But that was kind of the big takeaway for me, is just be observant. And looking at maps is super fun and cool, especially satellite images. Mm-hmm. And it's just really neat to honestly really take a look at that stuff and dive in. Another interesting note, too. I actually don't have a lot of experience with Google Maps on my phone, but with Apple Maps, the zoom limit to how far you can actually pinch in is actually pretty high. High altitude, I should say. It's not that close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And one thing I noticed, because another thing I like to do, like right before bed, we're laying in bed, I usually get on Weather Channel and like look at Weather Channel videos.
I don't know if you should admit that.
I know. But another thing I like to do is just go to the radar. And when the radar is on satellite image and you're zooming in, I noticed actually not long ago that the zoom is ridiculously close.
Oh.
Like it's actually really good. Because I think they don't, I don't know if they just don't expect people to do that. I don't know why they would care, but anyway, it's really good. So honestly, the Weather Channel satellite images are will get you a lot closer to the ground. So
it might be that you have to be connected to the internet to look at the Weather Channel, and Apple Maps can be used offline, right? So
well,
maybe it's
no.
a caching thing.
It actually can't be. The satellite images need to be online.
Oh, they do.
Otherwise,
okay.
they don't load. Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think that Apple just made an arbitrary limit and said we're going here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Anyway, back to the article. This is in Lambares, Croatia, and the eastern shore, there's a seabed jutting out from the eastern shore of the island of Korcula, K-O-R-C-U-L-A, and literally type in Korcula on Apple Maps or Google Maps, and it will take you right there. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the article, you'll see the image that he was looking at. Weirdly, it's reversed because a lot of your maps are north up, and it's actually south up, I think.
Oh.
Because I when I found it on maps, it's inherently north up unless you change it, and it was facing the other direction.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
That is, it must have gotten loaded into the website upside down and wasn't fixed or something.
Or somebody just loaded it that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe this person who wrote the articles in Australia and all their maps are south up. Who knows? I don't really know. Maybe north up's just a northern hemisphere thing.
I have no idea.
Who has any idea? Nobody. So anyway, check that out because it's super cool. You can literally go right there on the map and see it. And I thought that was really neat. But anyway, it's a large, shallow area on the seabed jutting out from the eastern shore of the island, like I said. And him and a colleague, actually, the archaeologist and a colleague, dove the area and discovered what they think is a Neolithic settlement from about 4500 BC, which is pretty sweet. And just looking at this, I wouldn't have really thought it was anything. Except for like a reef or something like that. It didn't really jump out at me. And looking at stuff like this also makes your eye a little more critical to find stuff like that. Because now when I'm scrolling maps in the middle of the night and I'm trying to get to sleep, like I'm looking for stuff like this.
Yeah, you totally.
And that's artifact identification and feature identification as well. You just need to see lots of examples of the thing. And then you start training your brain and training your eyes to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
So We always say that when we go on survey. It's like, oh, if I haven't seen these types of artifacts in a while, you got to kind of get your survey eyes in and train them, retrain them again.
Yeah, make sure you're looking for the thing that you're supposed to be looking for.
Yeah.
I thought this was really interesting because it's a Neolithic site or settlement that is underwater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think is pretty common around all the coastlines around the world because of the raising and lowering water levels, obviously, with the melting of Ice Age and all that stuff, right?
I just figured it was Neolithic dive gear. No.
No. Right. So,
Atlantis.
Anyway, I think that's really interesting to focus on the coastlines like that, to find these sites that are, I'm not going to say better preserved than the ones on land. Maybe they are. Water can sometimes preserve really well, and sometimes it can actually make things deteriorate worse. But mm-hmm. I just think it's such an interesting area of exploration where we can find things that maybe we haven't been able to find on land. Water is just, it's neat. And I know that there are underwater archaeologists. There's probably a lot of you guys out there. So keep on doing the good work. But I feel like we don't hear as much about it as you do like terrestrial archaeology. So I wish we would, because it's cool.
And I mentioned, well, they found some stone walls and things like that surrounding it. And presumably when they get in there, they'll find a lot of other stuff. But I mentioned Atlantis jokingly just a second ago. But one of the basis arguments for the Atlantis myth is, well, A, I think one of the older, was it Ptolemy or somebody, actually wrote about some kind of thing. And so people have been searching for it ever since.
Right.
But one of the reasons we know that it's almost completely unrealistic is because the march of human cognition and evolution and technology and everything like that was kind of the same in this part of the world. Like the Neolithic at 4500 BC is probably really similar to the Neolithic in other areas.
Right.
And people that are in the quote Neolithic are not necessarily, you know, doing crazy things. Now, not long after this, they started building pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not these guys, but
some civilizations did. Rapidly right. advanced but from this point.
Here's the problem. When you get to something that is fantastical as Atlantis was supposed to be, the glaciers have already pretty much melted, and your sea levels are not rising at nearly the rate that they would be when it was 4,500 BC, and now this is underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So to have an entire city, a coastal city, inundated with water, it would have to have been like a city, you know, 4,000 years ago
yeah.
or more.
Yeah.
And we just didn't have people building those types of cities that Atlantis is supposed to be at that time.
Right.
If it was 2,000 years later, and maybe the glaciers were still melting, well, I'm sure they still were, but, you know, the sea levels just weren't rising at the rate that they were before. So it just makes the whole thing a little unrealistic. And
unless you bring magic and aliens in.
I mean, if you bring aliens in, then they easily could have had a coastal settlement 10,000 years ago that is now underwater.
To be clear, we are not proponents of that theory.
I'm just saying, if aliens existed and they visited and made a city, it would be underwater if it were on the coast.
I mean, it would make sense.
Yeah, it would 100% be underwater right now, pretty much anywhere in the world.
Right.
And there's places like off the coast of California that are under, you know, 100 feet or more of water, and Washington and Oregon, because of the shelf over there.
Right.
That actually had people living on it, you know, 8,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So
that's why I'm so intrigued by coastline archaeology.
Yeah.
I don't really want to dive and do it myself, but right. I love hearing the results of what other people are doing with it.
It tells me that if we ever invent time travel and we're going to go back in time, and you don't want evidence of your, like if you have a base of operations,
mm-hmm.
put it on the coast.
Yeah,
because you know
be
it
underwater.
Will eventually be underwater.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
All right. Good advice for future time travel.
So
love it.
Our time travel statement for the day has been met. we're going to end this podcast now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So.
Where's your nerdy reference?
I know, right? So, again, check this out. Go look at maps. Have fun. It's super cool.
Yeah, so. There's like in the article, there's a little slideshow with a couple images.
All right.
And there's some cool pictures there, too, to check out. And actually, like the grid over the excavation underwater, which is really neat to see mm-hmm. how they grid that stuff out and then work on it basically just like you would on land. But it's underwater. And I imagine things move around a little bit more than they would like. But it still is neat how they do that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You got to wonder how much of that's in context anyway, just from 5,000 years of being underwater.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, definitely water moves things around a lot.
Anyway, let's move from Croatia to a much older time period and up in Michigan. And oddly enough, this isn't underwater because it's on land now, but there's plenty of underwater sites in that area under the Great Lakes as a result of also glacial melting. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 138 of the Archaeology Podcast. And as promised, we are going to Michigan in the United States, where what do they call him in the article? It's an amateur archaeologist, but that's what we would call him. But he was a
self-taught researcher.
So
no, that's not what they called him. Hold on. Independent researcher.
Right. Yeah. Not disparaging amateur archaeologists or avocational archaeologists or anything like that. But I think they're just giving him another term, because archaeologist implies we don't have any certification or anything like that, but it does imply some sort of educational level, I would say. Just like you wouldn't call yourself a physicist, even if you have a particle accelerator in your basement, unless you basically have a physics degree.
Right.
It's not like other things, right? So anyway, this guy, he likes to go over plowed fields. And plowed fields in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, which I guess technically is what Michigan is. Plowed fields, fields are plowed all the time because most of the landscape is farmland. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that's sitting not that far below the surface. And plows will pick up stuff from, you know, sometimes a foot or more below the surface. They'll just churn it up. I think probably more than that in some cases.
Yep.
And so one of the ways that you can start finding where things are is to walk a plowed field after it's recently been plowed and see if you find anything. Now, things could be dragged all over the place.
Yeah.
They're probably not going to be dragged by like the farm equipment itself, but it could be moved by other animals that come through there, livestock, stuff like that. So if you find something, there's a half decent chance that there's other stuff like it nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to do more observation through walking and then, of course, excavation.
Yeah, it's just a good like way to identify sites without having to do like shovel testing or anything like that. Because if you get a group of artifacts in an area in a plowed field, then like, okay, well, there might be more below that.
Right.
So, yeah.
So a little bit of context here before we start talking about what he found. A lot of Michigan was covered in a wall of ice up to a mile high. And I believe that ice sheet was called the Wisconsin Ice Sheet. I'm pretty sure it covered the entirety of the Great Lakes and then into New England.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's what carved out the Great Lakes, was that ice sheet advancing and retreating.
Mm.
So, but a mile thick. I just let that sink in for a second.
Insane.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So one of the cool things just to mention, if you've ever heard the term, I love this term. It's called isostatic rebound. And didn't have anything to do with here, but it's probably why this isn't underwater now, is because that ice was super heavy. It actually compressed the Earth's crust underneath it. And isostatic rebound is the slow rise in elevation as the landscape comes back. And if I'm not mistaken, it's still coming up.
As the glacier retreat, the land kind of slowly bounces back up.
And glaciers retreat and melt at the same time. That's how they retreat. They just melt. And so, and if I'm not mistaken, the land is still not fully done with its isostatic rebound.
Hmm.
Because it was compressed by so much. I don't know if they can tell how far down the land went, and they probably can, but they noted that it's still moving, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, 13,000 years ago. The campsite was dated to around that time, and this portion was obviously not under ice, but had to have been dramatically influenced by the ice. I kind of think of it as, here's my pop culture reference for the episode, a Game of Thrones thing where you're like sitting next to the wall in the north. Because that was basically ice.
Right.
It's like, who's just living at the base of that?
Right.
That's what I felt like this was. I mean, a mile high, that would have been a mountain of ice in the distance.
Yeah.
I mean, literally a mountain of ice.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And this is a really flat land. You would have seen that ice. I'm sure it tapered out like all glaciers do. It wasn't just like, bam, ice
like
for a
wall.
Mile.
Right.
Yeah. So if it was a mile thick, it probably tapered out for easily 20, 30 miles in front of it, you know, before it came out to nothing.
Right.
So anyway, the campsite, like I said, was dated to around that time. It was identified by this gentleman initially finding what we call Clovis artifacts. And these are stone tools with distinctive shape and construction. And Clovis tools have been found all over North America, all over South America.
Mm-hmm.
And that technology is really what's referred to as Clovis. I don't think anybody personally really thinks of the Clovis as a people because they were all over both continents.
Yeah, it's more called like the Clovis tradition or technology or whatever.
Exactly.
And it really just refers to like the fluted shape down the center of it.
Yeah.
That's like the main characteristic that ties all of these points together. It even could have been independently developed, really. Like it probably grew from group to group, but...
Yeah, it could have been, like you said, one of the reasons why this particular projectile point, we call it, is, I guess, popular at that time, is because the megafauna that still lived in this area of the world hadn't gone extinct yet.
Right.
There's many hypotheses as to why we don't have megafauna anymore. Some say it was overhunting, and some say it was just the world changed.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't live in that world anymore.
Yeah.
So I would imagine it's probably a mixture of both. But megafauna were, of course, huge.
Yeah.
And you used, bow and arrow hadn't been invented yet, but I don't think an arrow, unless you had, like, you see African tribespeople and ethnographic evidence of it, of them taking down like elephants and stuff like that. But they do it with arrows and spears, and the arrows, you know, there's 50 of them. They're just firing all at them. So that would have to be something like that. But you could take down bigger animals with fewer people if you had spears with big, huge tips on them.
Mm-hmm.
And those are Clovis points and other types of points too. But Clovis technology and that flute going down the middle from the base up is useful for hafting onto a spear tip,
because
you just split the wood on the end, you slide this point down on top of it, you wrap some sinew around it and, you know, some like fat from an animal and stuff to kind of solidify it all. And you've got an awesome spear tip.
Yeah. Pretty sturdy. And
yeah,
it's exactly what you need. Big spear for big animals, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think generally speaking, when you look at projectile point sizes throughout history, they just get smaller and smaller as we go through time, because game was getting smaller and, you know, they just didn't need to put as much time and effort into these big points, because that's the other thing about them, is they're beautiful and they're well constructed, but they're big. They must have taken a long time to make.
Yeah. And not only did the animals get smaller, but the technology got a little bit better too with the invention of the bow and arrow.
Oh, true. Yeah.
So, and a bow can shoot a projectile, and even like a crossbow can shoot a projectile at a very high rate of speed, but you're not going to put a big, heavy tip on the end of that.
Right.
You're just not, because you've got a wooden shaft. You need a smaller point. It's going to be going much faster and it's going to, you know, enter into the prey, but you'd also need to be able to kill that. So,
yep.
Anyway, this is thought to be the earliest site in Michigan now, and as with lots of articles, it's rewriting the story, as I think every archaeological site should. Like, if it didn't rewrite the story, what are you doing?
Yeah. Right? So, why are you even reporting on it?
What's going on here? Yeah. So, anyway, there's some other stuff in here that I guess I don't really know a whole lot about this area, just professionally. And these statements seem a little bit dubious to me, but they said the site was likely occupied by a small group of people who briefly lived on a river in southwest Michigan. Now, you can see evidence of rivers. You know where they are. There's no river there right now, but rivers meander in that type of soil. Mm-hmm. So there could have been a river there before, and we know how to find the previous meanders of rivers. But previous evidence had found that Michigan was practically uninhabitable at this time, and that there was little evidence that the people using the Clovis tradition had settled there. And the article actually says that the Clovis, as in there are people, but I think I want to get away from saying that, like I said.
Yeah. And that's because it was covered in a glacier, right?
Yeah.
So like there was no habitable land that we knew about.
Right.
But apparently that was wrong.
Apparently it was. Mm-hmm. So, and it just goes to say that this portion was either not covered by the glacier or was maybe on the fringe, and as the melt started to happen was one of the earliest places exposed. And in front of the glacier was a great place to be.
Yeah.
Because you had really fertile soils. They didn't have agriculture yet, but things could grow there that they could hunt and forage, they could forage for.
Yeah, and the game was there to eat. So follow the animals that you're killing. Oh,
there probably would have been excellent fresh water just pouring off the melting glacier.
Yeah.
And it would have been probably a pretty decent place to be.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this site is known as the Belson site. They're usually named after either the person that found it or the landowner. And I think in this case, it's the landowner.
I believe so.
Yeah. Actually, this is what I was looking for earlier. They said this was probably a smaller camp, but they said they think this is a short-term camp by a group that likely split off from a main group. And I don't know if they have evidence that people lived in bigger groups back then. Maybe that's the case. And this was a smaller like hunting party or something like that. Then maybe. But I'm not really sure where that evidence comes from.
It sure seems like we're getting into hypothesis territory there. And sometimes archaeologists can speak with a lot of authority about things that are all hypotheses. And one thing we should say about this article, too, we have an article that's a quick overview, and then we also have a longer article that is more in depth, and then that links to the actual academic paper that was written.
Mm-hmm.
However, the paper is behind a paywall, so we didn't get to read that actual like academic paper. So we're basically reporting on what's in these articles.
Yeah, indeed. So Thomas Talbot is the name of the self-taught researcher that found this initially, and he found his first Clovis point in 2008 on a farm. And when he found the piece over here, they just kept walking it and found more and more pieces over a short period of time, and then realized that he had multiple Clovis components, and then did the right thing and contacted the proper experts to come out there, which they, of course, had him helping out and you know, working on the excavation with him.
Yeah, which is really neat. Yeah. I like the enthusiasm behind somebody like that. And then he did the right thing by bringing in the researchers, and then they let him help. It seems like it was a really great relationship from that perspective.
Yeah.
Oh, also, I think one of the Clovis points that he found, it was in two pieces, and he found the two pieces at different times.
Yeah.
But they clearly went back together. So I think that was really good evidence that there was a larger site when you find two pieces disconnected but refitting.
Yeah.
So that was neat.
Yeah. And along those lines, a lot of that stuff in the plow zone was just spread out. Could have been broken by the plow.
Could be.
You know,
yeah.
Who knows? They probably did some research on it. You can kind of tell those sorts of things. You can tell if it's been broken for 5,000 years.
Yep.
Or was broke 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be real worn if it's an old break.
Yeah. They did find two distinct artifacts well below the plow zone, which tells them that they're in a primary context. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool.
Yep.
To date, as of when this article was written, August 23rd, 2021 is when it came out, they found more than 20 tools and hundreds of pieces of debitage. And debitage is the flaking remains of making a tool. Mm-hmm. So when you crack off the little rocks, the flakes, the whole assemblage of flakes that come off of that in that process is called debitage.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have to shape a point in a very specific way, and it makes these waste pieces that are very specifically shaped. And we know exactly what we're looking at when we see one.
Yeah, debitage is also known by debit age, if you're typing this into Microsoft Word. That's what it will autocorrect
debit
to.
Debit age. Yes.
One interesting thing that I'm glad they mentioned in the article, and I first found a popular article, actually our producer found a popular article about this, and that linked to the University of Michigan press release on it, which actually is a much more thorough article with a pretty cool YouTube video on there talking about it. So definitely take a look at that. But one of the things I'm glad they mentioned, because you have to note the discrepancies, is that the points here were very similar to another set of early points called Gainey points.
Oh.
G-A-I-N-E-Y. They also have a flute running up the center, and they're also spear points. There were other Clovis-like points in different parts of the world. And whenever we see a certain shape and we see that flute, we go Clovis. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's probably the right technology at the right time. And we see technology like that developing, and it could be cultural transmission. One person figures it out, another person finds it or meets them or something like that. And they're like, hey, I want to make these too. You know, a lot of people back then were flint knapping experts because they had to be, you know, it's like, I'm an expert at spreading peanut butter on bread because, you know, that's what I do.
Because you need to survive.
Need to survive. So, you know, back then you would have been an expert at flint knapping, at gathering, at knowing where things are.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but anyway, it was just the right technology at the right time to kill the right kinds of things. And these Gainey points could have been produced by similar people that came over with the Clovis technology or something like that. And and there's always slight modifications, so I'm sure it's related.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the point here is that this style of spear point is old. It's very old.
It's really old.
For me, the takeaway is that probably the prehistory of Michigan goes back farther than anybody realized. And this site is helping them figure out what those dates are. But it's old. Whether it's Clovis or Gainey or something entirely new. It's very old, and it takes the prehistory back further, which is cool.
One really cool thing that, and they're still researching these, is that the two different styles of points, Clovis and Gainey, they have very distinct flaking characteristics. That's one thing I did note, that when we're talking about different technologies being developed, but parallel evolution of technology as well, you can tell that it's definitely cultural in some cases when you see two different styles of the same kind of thing. So these are both spear points that are fluted, but Clovis points have large flakes taken off of them after the flute. Well, the flute's taken off last, basically. But you have all these flakes taken off, and they're large flakes, whereas the Gainey points are much smaller flakes with more strikes to create those.
Oh, okay.
So more time-intensive to create a Gainey. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that gives it some kind of advantage or if that was literally just how somebody did it.
It's just how they did it.
Yeah. And they just didn't know any better, and just like, this is how we're going to do it. Same thing with Clovis.
Right. So. People are still people. We always have to remember that. Like, people are people, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Like if what they were doing worked, why would they change it?
And finally, they're bringing in some other scientists. They've sent some of these points off to a Colorado lab that will be doing protein analysis that will determine the animals and plants that these spear points may have been used on. So that's pretty cool, bringing in some other scientists.
Yeah, I like that because I think it'll help them narrow in on exactly what these people were doing there and their lifestyle, you know? So that's cool. I hope they can get some really good data from those resources.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's head from the United States and finding these prehistoric paleo treasures to some more recent treasures as determined by the name of the article. I hate it when they use the word treasure in an article.
It gives archaeology a bad rap, man.
That's right. Yeah. We're headed to Poland. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the third and final segment of episode 138 of the Archaeology Show. And as I said, we're going to Poland.
We're actually moving forward in time compared to the other two articles, but we're still super old here, like 2300 to 1800 BCE. So
right.
This is a episode full of old stories.
That's right.
And not treasure, damn it.
I know. So this article is called Farmer Finds Rare Treasures from, and I am going to get this wrong, Unitice or Unit, I don't know, UNETICE, and there are some weird characters over the U and the E, so, but their
Unity?
Culture. Yeah, something like that.
Let's go with Unity.
Yeah. Sulacyn County of Poland, also pronouncing that wrong. But this is another example where somebody found something in farmland. Again, mm-hmm. plow zones.
Yep.
Right? So this one was found by a farmer, though, and the culture that is related here is also called, now we said unitice or whatever it is, it's also called the Enjutits culture. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like Rachel said, dated to 2300 to 1800 BC. Now, these sites and this culture have been identified across the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Germany, and Poland.
Quite the range.
This site dates to the start of the Central European Bronze Age, and that's pretty much what was found. This farmer found metal objects and then contacted the authorities, which resulted in an archaeological assessment and excavation. Again, two examples of people basically doing the right thing,
yeah,
which is pretty cool. So they recovered three scepters, three Bronze Age daggers, a hatchet, a chisel, and several other metal artifacts. It just says metal artifacts, probably because they didn't really know what they were used for. But these look, man, these are super cool.
And yeah.
I think to do bronze like this, you need to cast it, if I'm not mistaken. Like, you need to build something around it and pour the molten material in. I don't think these were pounded out.
Probably. They must. I mean, when you look at them and you see the
detail.
The point, like, sticking off of them. They look like torture devices. Like,
yeah, they don't look pleasant.
No, they're labeled as daggers, I think, this first picture. And I'm like, which is the dagger end? It looks like you can kill somebody with any of those ends.
Yeah. When you're looking at this, the pointy end is down. That would have been the dagger.
Yeah.
And then the wooden handle would have been around the rest of it. That's why there's points there.
Oh, so the wood would like
squished
stick
onto
to
it.
The, oh, okay.
And probably halves of a piece of wood or something like that, and then wrapped with a handle or something.
Okay.
And then there's a flat piece out to the left in the picture. If I'm not mistaken, that is like you're holding that with your thumb under that part. And that's kind of a protection against, like, the hilt of a sword.
Oh.
It's kind of a protection against something else hitting you there.
Okay.
So.
Oh, I see. Okay, that makes sense. It's like a shield for your thumb. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really know a whole lot about
really
old daggers. So this is interesting for that
reason.
Yeah,
my really old dagger knowledge is actually staggeringly good. So.
Yeah. I don't know. You're not really. Got to bring it a little better here, I think.
I guess so. Anyway, the metal industry with this culture was, and I guess this is based on what we found, was concerned with producing weapons and ornaments mainly as status symbols for high-ranking people rather than for equipping soldiers or for domestic use. So they must be able to tell with other Bronze Age artifacts as a comparison that these are less functional and more ornamental.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So these artifacts could have been buried just for storage, like, I don't know, maybe there was a house there, or maybe somebody just was like, I'm gonna bury these out here in case I need them again.
Hmm.
Or it says riches hidden because of enemy action or conflict. So oh my God, who's that coming through the trees? Bury the good stuff.
Right. Hide it now. I suppose it's possible that like it was just like left in a structure and then the structure collapsed and eventually went away. And then you have this and it looks like a cache of some sort, but it's just the remnants of people living somewhere.
Yeah. And we always call those kinds of things caches when we find them over here. Like we found remember that cache of stone points that I found?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we call them caches here. But often I hear in Europe, they are always referred to as a hoard, whether it's coins or whatever.
Okay.
And the article even says that this is the second hoard to be found in this area this year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's like a European term, maybe
it's
for
just a preferred term that they have.
Grouping of artifacts. Okay, cool. Yeah, I can get down with that. A hoard.
And it might be specifically related to something somebody intentionally buried, like they're hoarding artifacts, or they're hoarding their objects right here, whatever those may be, and that's where it is. Or that really is just the term. I don't really know. So.
That's true. And they are kind of indicating that they think that these might have been buried on purpose based on like the wording. So if it was buried on purpose, then like hoard would be the right word for that.
Because
they're trying to protect it and intending to come back to it. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder how you could know that, though. How do you know that it's buried on purpose versus discarded or forgotten about?
Well, if it were forgotten about, I mean, discarded, they wouldn't be all together, I wouldn't think.
Unless they're in a privy.
Well, that's true. Forgotten about, for sure. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
So, all mixed together. But anyway, that's pretty much it. Pretty short article on that one.
Yeah.
But it's really neat. I thought it was good to highlight the farmer find and doing the right thing and calling the authorities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not going to come take your land. They just want to see what's there and learn from it.
Yeah, exactly. And it turned into an excavation, which I'm sure the farmer was, you know, gracious enough to allow them to do that, which is really great. And, you know, if you're a person out there that owns land and you think that there might be something buried on it, then don't do anything yourself, but call in the authorities, and then you might get to like learn about the prehistory of your area, of your land that you own.
And in the United States, you generally own anything that is found on your land.
Mm-hmm.
That's how land ownership works here, with the exception of like mineral and water rights. Those are very different. But things like this, you technically do. They belong to you, and it's up to you to say, well, I want to donate these, I want to send them back to wherever, or if you just want to keep it, you can. But that's not the case in a lot of other countries.
Oh, true.
So keep that in mind if you're, like, I don't know what the case is in Poland, but like in the UK, the crown basically owns everything under the ground.
They do. That's right, because you hear about people finding, like, hordes of coins and stuff like that, and they have to turn it over.
The queen's like, thank you.
Our coffers were running low. Thank you.
That's right. She was running out of hats to wear.
I don't think that lady has ever run out of hat.
Yeah, probably not. All right. So that is it for this week.
So next week, we have a really fun episode for you guys. We're going to watch the movie Ammonite, which came out last year. I know we kind of missed the boat on that one. We probably should have talked about it last year, but we're doing it now. So, you know, grab your streaming service. Hulu, I think, is the one that it is streaming on, or you can purchase it at the various places and give it a watch, because it's a not accurate representation of a real person named Mary Anning, and she was a self-taught paleontologist in England in the 1800s. So her story is really cool. This is tangential to archaeology. So, like, let's just go ahead and, you know, it's not archaeology, but fine. It's cool, and she was cool, and she deserves a spotlight on her. So watch that movie if you want to. We're going to talk about the movie. We're going to talk about her, and we're going to talk about what they got right and wrong in the movie. We haven't actually watched it yet, so I'm sure we're going to have lots to say about that. So, yeah, join us next week.
All right. See you next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.